You're listening to Coach Your Brains Out by Gold Medal Squared. Drew Brannon joins us once again. It's time to talk about pressure.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
All right, we're going to move on to another topic of competing under pressure, or, you know, playing with pressure. So, you know, I talked to Tom Black, and he works. I know you work with his team, and he suggested talking about this topic of being under pressure. So, I was just curious. First, what's your approach to discussing pressure with athletes?
The place I always start with that is helping athletes develop a healthy understanding and perspective on what pressure really is. And so many people can kind of resonate with the physiological occurrences or reactions to pressure. So we tend to start there of when an athlete experiences pressure, some of the symptoms, so to speak, that the result from that are even what I mentioned earlier, I think in our conversation of, you know, heart rate picks up a little bit, respiration picks up, blood flow picks up, mind goes a little quicker, sweaty palms, all those things. And so if an athlete's view of what I just described is one of concern and negativity and almost panic, well, it's going to be really hard to be good under pressure for obvious reasons. So what we've got to do is deconstruct that and help them understand that all that's happening in that moment is it's their body's way of communicating to them that they are engaged in a meaningful experience. And that word is really, really important of it's a meaningful opportunity because that's what pressure situations are. Like, you know, if you're in a key point in a game or a match or whatever type of sport you play, it's meaningful. The reason you feel that way is because you care. You're invested in this emotionally. You're invested in the livelihood of your team. You want to do the best you can for the people around you. All of that is extremely healthy. And so the viewpoint or the perspective of what's actually happening to me right now, it has everything to do with my ability to handle it. And so if I construct it that way, and if my notion of pressure is, man, this is exciting. Like I'm at a moment in my life right now where I'm able to be privileged to meaningful, engaging work, meaningful, engaging opportunities. That's more of a mentality that people are going to embrace. They're not going to fear their bodily reactions. They're going to kind of lean into the execution that needs to happen in those moments. And so I think framing it is huge. And then the second piece of it is just equipping them with the skills needed to manage that moment. And so that's mind and body. It's helping them understand how to ground their thinking through what I call an anchoring technique. It's helping them understand how to regulate their breathing appropriately to keep heart rate down. We target mind and we target body to give them the skills they need to execute.
What would be an example of an anchor for, let's say, indoor volleyball?
It needs to be a foundational truth that helps a person feel grounded and almost safe, if you want to call that. So an example would be like, let's say I'm about to receive a serve and I've got a brief 3 seconds to kind of collect myself. If a person were to say to themselves, fully in this moment, I love my team, all I have for them. So that thought right there, that series of thoughts, it's trying to drive their mind into the present. They're reminding themselves that the people around them, there's a two-way dynamic of care that exists there and that I care for them and they care for me. And then we drive the behavior into not perfection, but execute. So drive it into effort, which is a controllable. We always want to drive that final thought of the sequence into a controllable, actionable behavior that we believe will increase the likelihood of success.
Got it. Cool. How do you recommend talking about, I guess, big matches? Are there big matches, or should coaches and teams treat preseason games the same as the NCAA finals?
Yes. One of my mentors years ago tried to sell me on the idea that there are no such thing as big games. But my, I think the reason I could never get to that was I played college basketball once upon a time. And I definitely knew the difference in a big game and a not so big game. And I just couldn't get there. Like I know for a fact, I never felt the same going into it, what I felt like was a big game than I did a different game. So I do believe there are big games. Now the caveat here is I don't believe we should prepare differently or approach big games any differently than we do other games. So although they feel different, our process for getting ready shouldn't be any different. I think we need to know going in that some of the things we just talked about regarding pressure, like we might see more of that. We might deal with more, evidence of adversity, but we don't really want to change how we go about our business.
Cool. Yeah, because I feel like sometimes a coach might be worried about mentioning that it's a big game, thinking he'll amp the team up too much, but it's also not acknowledging probably what they're already feeling.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, especially this day and age, like you with the, when I was playing basketball 20 plus years ago, obviously there was no thing as social media. We had no idea if certain people were saying certain things about the gravity or weightiness or magnitude of a game. Like we didn't know. We just knew what we thought about it. And so this day and age, if you try to kind of like downplay or pretend like something isn't a significant game, I do think you run a little bit of a risk there of almost kind of creating some confusion amongst the team. Like, now we're not going to spend an hour long team meeting talking about how big it is, but I think it is important to acknowledge reality.
Yeah. And then I guess like other than stakes, I've also found that just expectations lead to pressure. How would you recommend framing a match where maybe your team is the favorite or they believe they should win?
Yeah. I'll freely admit this is maybe becoming more and more kind of cliched in sports, but I wholeheartedly believe this, that we want to compete to what we have identified as our standard as a team. And so we're trying to meet and or exceed our internal standard of competing. And we're going to trust that if we do that, we'll win more than we lose. So the standard exists independent from the opponent. I also think that's how you as a team combat some level of anxiety and pressure is, although you are like in volleyball, for example, you're competing whoever's on the other side of that net. I think if we compete to surpass our standard, it creates more of a controllable notion of the game. And it's less about them or what they might do to us and more about like our attempt to vie together to meet what we have set out as where we hope to be. So I think you make it more about the standard than you do the opponent.
Yeah, it's a great call, great message. I was thinking of kind of the opposite way where maybe you're not expected to win. And then, is the talk like, well, we've got to play out of our minds and we've got to go for it more. But it sounds like when you're really clear on your standards and who you are, who you want to be, then the other side is, less a part of the equation.
Yeah, and I think that there are so many examples in sports of upsets and underdogs doing incredible things. But I would argue even in those situations, they were able to do that because they stayed true to who they were. They played to their strengths. And I think if some of what they benefited from was playing aggressively and taking chances, then I would argue those are their strengths in a sense. And it was less about being an anomaly and more about just, aligning to who they are.
And then that standard that you're holding your team to, is that a measurable thing based on like the skills of the given sport, or is it more like an effort level and the feeling of, I guess, intensity?
I think it could be both. There are certain measurables obviously that exist in every sport, but then I think there's also, in our data driven sport analytic era we're living in, everything's measured. And so like I think about example, there's a program at Georgia that I know one of the coaches as well. And so on her team, one of the things they measure that's a standard for them is touches. And I don't just mean like, deflections and things like that, but like they've found that if they get at least 100 touches a game, they win more. And so that's, you know, giving people five, helping people up off the floor. They chart everything. And so that's a standard right there, because I would, you know, I think my understanding of that would be when we have a higher touch frequency in a game, what does that mean? It means we're engaged in it, our heart's in it, where there's effort involved. All of the things that I think are going to drive success.
That's a great example. I always think, you think of measuring, you know, kills and digs and things like that, but yeah, measuring how good a teammate you are by picking someone up off the ground. That's great. If you could measure that, I like that.
Yeah. I just think it's, you know, we talk a lot about process goals and what's the process. You know, I think that's sometimes an overused notion in sports, but that example we just talked about right there is an effective way to measure what I would call a process variable. You know, like we need to, as you said, we got to be great teammates. We got to be engaged in what we're doing. We've got to give effort. And those are not easy things to measure. And you really got to get creative in order to do it well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good example though. So what would you do with an athlete who is really comfortable, they're themselves and, you know, they're confident in practice, but when the pressure of a game comes, you just see a different person?
I'd want to start with just trying to kind of peel back the layers through a good, let's put it on the table type conversation and see what we find there. Now, the possibility is, of course, that they don't really know. I've seen plenty of athletes that can't tell you why when they get into those moments, they become another version of themselves. What I have found can help that sometimes is to bring in some video clips and let's look at those together and let's talk through what was going on pre-play, during, and then post as well, and try to understand, like, help them dial into some self-talk throughout those moments, and try to go that angle with it. And then it's about kind of retraining thinking, and there's so many possibilities that exist. I mean, I've had situations where you're trying to look in all the right places, and ultimately what you find out is it's a parent dynamic where they just can't handle, like, after the game, they're so fearful of afterwards. We're talking about college athletes getting that phone call from mom or dad or whoever that they just can't play. There's just too much pressure. So there's so many things there. You just have to be very thorough in how you try to understand it.
What do you recommend athletes do before or the day of leading up to a game to deal with nerves and pressure? Is there any kind of self-talk or exercises that would be helpful?
It definitely depends on them. I mean, I think one of the ways I always challenge athletes is it's important that they develop kind of their blueprint or their process of how I prepare. And part of what that means, you know, that doesn't just include how many hours I eat before a game or how I hydrate or what time I go to bed the night before. Those are certainly important things, but, you know, every preparation routine I believe has three primary components. One is physical. What are you doing to physically prepare yourself to be ready to execute? Number two is what I would just call strategy or tactical. Like, do you know what you need to do to be effective? Do you know the scouting report? Those type of things. And then thirdly is mental and emotional. And all three of those are vital components to preparation. And so what I find is the mental emotional piece is the least explored piece of that. And ironically, it's sometimes the primary reason people don't perform and why they do become kind of overwhelmed with pressure and things like that. And so it's about knowing yourself, knowing how you put your mind at ease, reviewing vision type statements or mission type statements before the game to kind of ground you in the things that are important to you. It's different for every athlete. The most important thing is that you've invested the time to figure out what they need.
Cool. And I know you already mentioned anchoring, but what about, like, what would you tell an athlete who in crunch time at the end of the game feels that pressure mounting and the thoughts in their head start pulling their attention away from that next play? Like, in that moment, what are some things you can do to kind of get back on track?
Yeah, a little bit of overlap to that point we said earlier about anchoring, but then also I would really encourage them to do everything, and this is hard. Like, none of this is easy in these moments, to direct their thoughts as much as they can into, as we said earlier, some type of controllable or a specific skill or micro skill needed for the execution of whatever comes next. So for example, like let's take volleyball. If it's about serving, focus their thoughts on their feet, their explosiveness, the swing of, you know, the toss of the ball, this like cues, focus their, cause really what's happening there, this is how I explain it. An example would be like a keyhole in a door, in that when you, once you place a key in that door, there's no room for another key to fit in that same hole. And so the mind works in a similar way, in that when you fully engage yourself in a thought of some type, it's really difficult to simultaneously focus on another one. So if we can just get their thought, their mind working and moving toward a thought that's functional and that serves the need of the situation well, it's going to be much more difficult for them to also be thinking about what concerns them.
Makes sense. And then what about with coaches? What can coaches do in training so that they can give players chances to practice that competing or practice playing under pressure?
Yeah. It's tough. You know, I think because the way I look at it is I kind of create a rating system or a number system. And I think about between 1 and 10. And so 10 would be crunch time of a hugely important match. And it's, you know, fifth set, like, this is it. This is it type moment. That's a 10. A 1 is, if we're talking about volleyball, like open gym, we're going to roll the balls out and you guys go play and the coaches will be kind of in and out. We may not even show up that much. That's a 1. And what happens, you know, in a bad situation, practice looks too much like a 2 and a 3. And that's why when players get in 9 and 10 type moments, they freak out because the gap is too great. And so I think the challenge for coaches is creatively, how do we make 5, 6, and 7s on a consistent basis so that when the big moments show up, the leap isn't too great. And, you know, the way you create those 5, 6, and 7s, of course, varies by sport, but I think it's about, you know, creating competition in within practice with consequences attached for the loser, making it difficult, changing it up, make it dynamic, really, really pushing people with change in routine, and not allowing them to walk into a single practice where they just feel like they kind of know what's coming.
I had one more, it's kind of just, this is a random question. I was listening to your podcast, The Growth Project, which I strongly recommend. It's a great podcast. And your episode on core values, I really enjoyed it. And at one point you were talking about how, you know, sometimes people are surprised when they hear that results are out of your control. Mm-hmm. And I've had the same experience where people find that a negative thing to lose control. But you talked about really framing that as a positive thing. And I guess, yeah, I was, if you could elaborate on that and like why you think that can be seen, you know, losing control could actually be a positive thing.
I think that, so if you create an example, we'll even make it in sports where it's a championship game, doesn't matter the sport or the level or anything, and it's pregame and athletes are sitting back in a locker room just, and it's quiet in there. I mean, I've been in those situations, it's quiet in there, and you know, you're not yet at the point where we're starting to play, like, you know, pump up music and get excited. We're just, people are getting dressed and it's quiet. It's tense. And the reason it's tense is because people are aware of the fact that it might not go their way. They're afraid of that. They're nervous about that. And in the concern of, gosh, you know, we came this far, we're right on the cusp of doing it, but we might lose. That's why they're nervous. So I think when we realize and when people can get their minds around the fact that, well guess what? Like, you don't ultimately directly control the outcome of this anyways. It can be a really, really freeing thought for people. And in that sense, it becomes good news of, like, if I'm back in that locker room and I'm tense and I'm worried, why should I be worried about something I don't control anyways? You know, I've even used the example before. It's not that different from, like, sitting around in your house and kind of wringing your hands worried about the fact that it might rain that day. You know, there's nothing you can do about it. Like, why are we wasting our time and our energy getting that worked up about something we can't control? And so I know it sounds simple and it sounds easy, but the fact of the matter is if you could control outcomes, you would only experience positive ones. you know, I don't know who would ever opt for a losing in a championship game. And so I think as soon as we can help athletes kind of really get that and let go of some of the results-based concern, now we can get busier applying that energy and effort and emotion to the places where we can exert some level of control in the process of it all.
Hmm. So you're kind of shifting, just becoming aware of what you can control and then shifting the focus there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Like it.
Cool. Well, we have some listener questions to finish this up. Georgia assistant coach Aaron Benning asks, in times of stress and athlete perceived crisis, how can coaches help guide athletes to better connect with the trust of their own abilities and the work they have built in?
Yeah. So the phrase that I heard this somewhere a long time ago, and I really like it. And you guys, I'm sure, are familiar with it as well. Trust your training. I like that a lot. And then I added this to it because it's not always just about sports, but trust your training and trust yourself. To me, what I like about that is, particularly if you look at collegiate athletes, these men and women invest so much of themselves, so much time, so much effort, so much emotion. They've laid a foundation at that point that will yield and produce results. Like they've done the work, they've paid the price. One of my coaches used to always say the hay is in the barn. And so I think when stress is high, coaches have to help athletes remember to trust themselves, to realize that there's more, that sometimes they don't understand the capability they truly possess to kind of navigate themselves out of trouble. Now, we're talking about stress very generically, and so of course there could be some situations where they can't navigate themselves out of trouble, but I think more often than not, we want to empower them to fight for what's needed there and trust their ability to get it.
Nice. And another one, another listener, Felicia Turner. I'm not used to calling her Turner, assistant coach at Georgia as well. She says, for a coach, what is the best approach to help their athletes overcome mental barriers such as lack of confidence and doubt?
Catching them doing something right is huge. You guys kind of alluded to this either or earlier. What I find when people are low on confidence, they can do 39 things right and one thing wrong. And when they walk out of the gym that night, the main thing they're focused on is that one thing during times where confidence is really at a low point. And so catching them doing something right is huge. Helping them identify small wins, providing good constructive feedback. And then here's a huge one is for coaches to really be aware of their nonverbals. Because even if, you know, if we've got an athlete who's struggling, and so a coach might be really on top of their language, of how they're trying to kind of talk to the athlete and encourage and empower the athlete, but that's not the only thing that the athlete is measuring to decipher what they think the coach thinks of them. And that, so that nonverbals is a very important thing to stay on top of in those situations.
Yeah, that's a good one. I don't hear it talked about much. And a coach has to have a high level of awareness of their nonverbals. So I think that's great to point that out. Good call. Any books you recommend? Any things you're listening to that are helping you grow?
Yeah, I'm reading a book right now called Seeing Around Corners, and it's a little bit more of a it's a business use type book. It's not a sports book per se, but I just really like to read books that make me think and get me trying to, I think, more creatively. So it's a really neat book about identifying inflection points and just how things innovate. Mm-hmm. So it's by authors Rita McGrath. And I think she's a Harvard Business School professor. She's a business school professor somewhere, probably someplace that I couldn't even get into if I applied, either now or in my earlier in life. But so that's been a really neat read. And then I'm always a fan of, I know a lot of people probably on this podcast have read all his books, but I do like Ryan Holiday a good bit and have read, I read Stillness is the Key recently and enjoyed that.
Nice. Yeah. I want to check that one out. That's his newest one, right?
Yeah. It was good.
Good. I'll check it out. And then for, I know you work with lots of successful businesses, sports teams. Is there any kind of common, I don't know, correlations you see between, you know, the leaders who are the most successful in those environments?
Yeah. The two words that immediately come to mind, one would be composed. I feel like the best leaders, whether it's in business or in sports that I've been around and had the chance to observe, have a high level of composure, particularly around adversity. And then the second one would be just curious. I think the best, it floors me at times. I think about some of the best business leaders that I work with, and they ask so many questions. Mm-hmm. And they're not afraid to do that, right? So like I've catch myself in meetings at times, and they're just, it's like rapid fire, question after question after question. And there's, it's, what's cool about that to me is the intent is so clear and pure, and that it's just this mentality of, like, we want to do the best we possibly can. We want to be as good as we possibly can be. I want to be as best as the best I possibly can be as a leader. And it's such a focus on that, and so minimal, if any, mindfulness toward weakness or like concern of being vulnerable. It's a really neat thing to see. And so I would say composed and curious.
Nice. The two C's.
Yeah, there you go. C squared.
Easy to remember. Cool. That's a great way to end it. Well, we really appreciate you sharing all of your knowledge, your experience, all the helpful insights. We definitely learned a lot here, and jealous of that Tom gets to learn so much from you, but I know you're going to be great for that program there, and look forward to continuing to follow along with the Growth Podcast and learning from what you guys are doing.
Well, thank you guys for the opportunity. I appreciate the chance to talk. I love thinking about a lot of the things we discuss. I appreciate that, and wish you guys the best as well.
Cool. Well, thanks, Drew.
Thanks. Take care.
Thanks, Drew.